Voices. I'm Alan Wilcox, Editor-in-Chief of Epidemiology. In 2002, the journal began a project to interview our field's most senior and accomplished practitioners. In these interviews, scientists reflect on their careers, their professional influences, and on the future of epidemiology. The interview you're about to hear is with Frank Spicer. Dr. Spicer founded Harvard's research program in the epidemiology of chronic diseases. He's responsible for initiating both the Nurses' Health Study and the Harvard Six Cities Study, two of the most influential cohort studies ever conducted. In his current research, Dr. Spicer focuses on the health effects of acute and chronic exposures to indoor and outdoor air pollutants. This interview was conducted by Doug Dockery in 2007.
Conversation with Frank Spicer. Frank's Edward Cass Professor of Medicine at the Harvard Medical School and Professor of Environmental Sciences at the Harvard School of Public Health. And we're going to talk today about his career. And I'm Doug Dockery. Professor of Environmental Epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health. So, Frank, I guess the first question is that few people start out with the intent of being an epidemiologist. And how did you get on this pathway? What was the incentive that brought you into epidemiology?
Well, early in my college career, I thought I was going to be a geneticist. A standard, at that time, standard sort of genetics, biology kind of training. And I took a course from a visiting professor from Chicago. This was at Stanford. And he, we got friendly and sort of an advanced genetics, human genetics course at that time, which was a very non-biochemical and non-laboratory. And we got to talking, and he said that he is a PhD geneticist, and he had no trouble doing his work in Chicago, but when he came to the West Coast, he found that he could not do human genetics, mainly because he was not a physician. And he encouraged me to go to medical school to get an MD degree and then to take up the postdoctoral training in genetics so that I'd be able to combine doing human genetics in a hospital setting because I would have an MD degree. Well, I took him up on that. I went to medical school, and during that time and shortly thereafter, the field of human genetics changed completely. We lost a couple of genes. We went from 48 to 46. It became very biochemical, and I lost interest at that point. But it was pretty clear early on that I was not a typical medical student. I couldn't memorize everything that had to be memorized to be a medical student. I was much more interested in the mathematical basis of things. And so I had to try to find a career, and I was struggling with this. I had to find a career that I could combine medicine and mathematics. And simply because of personal social reasons, my father-in-law was dying and I needed a job in Los Angeles, I took up a job with John Goldsmith, who was at that time, had just come from the Harvard School of Public Health back to the state of California, and I was doing air pollution epidemiology in Los Angeles, and I took a summer job with him to be in Los Angeles. I had no particular interest, and I discovered that you could do lots of mathematics in the field of what was then environmental epidemiology, but not named such. And combine mathematics with medicine. And that's how I sort of got into sort of the interest in respiratory disease, because we were doing pulmonary function tests on veterans at a veterans hospital in Los Angeles. And I got turned on by that. And that's how I got into it.
So how has the field changed since then? What do you see?
Well, at that time, we measured air pollution at the Wadsworth VA in West Los Angeles by whether we could see the mountain. The degree to which we could see the mountain was the measure of air pollution that we used. Probably a very good measure of small particles in the air. So certainly from the standpoint of monitoring exposures, there's been dramatic changes that have occurred over the last 40, 50 years in terms of both technology as well as understanding of what's in the air. I think we've learned an awful lot, and in terms of being able to make measurements and watch the pollution levels come down, I think that that's been a very dramatic change. In terms of instrumentations of monitoring both people and looking at people, I think we've developed a wide variety over this period of time of standardized approaches, both from the standpoint of getting historical information by questionnaires as well as pulmonary function tests, although I think the development of the pulmonary function test hasn't changed very much in the last 30 years.
But from those air pollution studies, you went on to cohort studies.
Yeah, my main interest was not just the air pollution. I got more interested, I suppose, in the respiratory disease side of things and trying to understand the natural history of chronic respiratory disease. And I guess I recognized that to do that, one needed to have large teams of people working on it. I mean, one person could never really study the natural history of chronic respiratory disease. One could not live long enough to study the natural history, and so you really had to develop, and which took some years, but developed over the years, the idea that with sort of overlapping relatively short-term, in terms of lifespan, relatively short-term prospective studies, 10 to 15 years in different age groups, one could piece together the natural history of chronic respiratory disease. And that's really what sort of the main focus of a lot of my work was early on.
So how did you
transition
to that?
Well, I had the good fortune of being able to stand on the shoulders of a number of giants. I worked with people who provided me with sort of the opportunities to sort of first get the basic understanding of how you go about doing this kind of work, and then sort of the stimulus for sort of the areas in which the work ought to be done in, and sort of how to sort of bring this to a larger sort of what at that time might be called big science approach to the problem. I spent a couple of years at the School of Public Health, Harvard School of Public Health, working in Jim Wittenberger's department, learning sort of basic physiology and doing work with exposures to sulfur dioxide and both in dogs and humans, working with some very competent physiologists. At the same time, working with sort of what might be called the early epidemiology of what was going on in chronic respiratory disease with Ben Ferris. And then had the opportunity, again through Jim Wittenberger's efforts, to go to England and work with Sir Richard Dahl, who was sort of the grand master of a cohort study, is the idea of a long-term cohort study. And in that connection, got to work with Charles Fletcher, who was doing a prospective study of chronic respiratory disease. So with that background, coming back here and understanding what I wanted to do in terms of studying the natural history of chronic respiratory disease, it was pretty straightforward as to how to go about doing it. Again, Jim Wittenberger became a very important component in that he led Ben Ferris and myself into the Harvard Six City study, which I saw as an opportunity to study natural history of disease from childhood and adult life, along with the study of the air pollution aspects.
Soon after that, you started the Nurses' Health Study.
Well,
what
yeah.
was the motivation for it?
The Nurses' Health Study actually started about 10 years before it really started. When I was in England in the 60s, we were seeing, I was working in Richard Dahl's unit with Martin Vesey, and we were seeing reports of healthy young women coming down with pulmonary emboli and thrombophlebitis in their legs. And the association of that with oral contraceptives was pretty apparent. It didn't take long to sort of figure that out. But what was very clear was that literally hundreds of millions of women were going, healthy women, were going to be put on a very potent drug, very effective, but very potent drug, and no one was considering the long-term consequences of taking that drug. And there I was sitting in the basement of Richard Dahl's unit with shelves behind me of forms that had been used in the smoking and doctor study, and it just seemed unnatural that one should look at whether or not you could set up a cohort of women to look long-term at the effects of oral contraceptives. Now, when we first started out, we actually did a pilot study in England. We did a study of doctors' wives. Because the doctors were registered, it was easy to find them, and it was a way of getting at a population that could be followed prospectively. We had a very effective pilot study in England. I can't remember, I think about 95% of the responses. Dahl signed the original letter that went out, so we obviously got good responses. And we were about to launch a larger study when we actually realized that there weren't enough women in the right age group there to do the study. There were only about 22,000 women who would fit the age group that we needed. So I came back to the United States and did a very similar pilot study here, again using doctors' wives. And it was effective enough. We got about a 70% response rate in the initial pilot studies with doctors' wives. Very elaborate system whereby the doctor got two letters, one with an identifying piece of information on it only, and the other with a questionnaire to give to his wife. And all this was to come back in separate envelopes so that we could maintain confidentiality. And it was effective. It was a pretty good pilot study. So we actually proceeded to submit a grant for funding, which we did eventually get. And just about the time we got the funding, we thought we better do another pilot of the two-year follow-up of the doctor's wives. And when we did that, we divided the groups into three groups. One was we decided we would send the same questionnaire out to the doctor, give this to your wife. A second group that we sent to Ms. directly to the Ms. woman, and a third sent to Mrs. woman. And the worst response rate at that time came from the Ms. group. In 1971-72, married women aged 30 to 55 did not like to be called Ms. But the most important group that responses we got was a group from the Mrs. group who said they had never seen the first questionnaire. Their doctor husbands had filled it out for them. And we saw ourselves as being dead in the water at that point. There was no way we could do a study in which the doctors were filling out the questionnaires for their wives. And that's why we switched to nurses. And so, and in fact, in effect, the nurses' questionnaire went out 10 years after we actually started thinking about the study in 1976.
So that approach has evolved into a series of prospective cohort studies?
Yes, yeah. In 1976 we started, in 1980 we added the very large dietary component with your Walt Willett's efforts. In 1986 we added, Walt took on starting the health professional study. And in 1989 we added a group of younger nurses to get at the question of the use of oral contraceptives before first pregnancy, which we could not answer with the first cohort, which didn't have the opportunity to use oral contraceptives starting at age 30. When we started the cohort at age 30, they would not have had the opportunity to have used oral contraceptives before the first pregnancy, very many of them. And then, in fact, I think it was 92, I believe, Graham Colditz started the offspring of the nurses' two cohort, so that we have a group of children that are also being followed.
So how has this approach, how has epidemiology changed from those early studies to what we're doing now?
Oh, I think there have been dramatic changes. I think it's not clear that large-scale cohorts like we've established are any longer affordable. So I don't think you can do the kind of stuff that we've been doing in the past with through the sort of same methods that we've used. And in fact, we're in the throes of sort of piloting another approach where we're going to use the computer far more than we'll use the males, I hope, to look at.
Web-based
approaches rather than paper and pencil-based approaches. And those are sort of being piloted at the present time. It's not clear that how many more of these cohorts are needed at this point, at least in terms of sort of the chronic disease among middle-aged women. There are a whole host of questions that relate to the origins of disease that drive us to think more and more about younger and younger populations. And it becomes that much more difficult to follow younger populations, as we discovered in the Six City study. Once these kids get out of school, it's very hard to continue to follow them. So I think the approaches will have to change. The approaches, there are many more approaches now than we had originally. When we started, I don't think people ever thought that you could get male responses, postal responses, to be as high as we were able to get them. I'm not sure we could get them again if we tried now. I think the world has become much more complicated. So I think that different approaches will have to be used to try to establish cohorts. I think once one makes a commitment to these cohorts, though, I think they have to be long-term commitments, because the results become more and more powerful as time goes on. The other aspect of this that's changed dramatically is the sort of biochemical side of it and genetic side of it. I think we've got to have biologics more now than we did early on. I think we've answered the simple questions. The more complicated questions are going to require a combination of both, not only questionnaire information, good phenotype information, but physiology and biochemistry, as well, and plus genetics.
So you mentioned that you've stood on the shoulders of giants and mentioned several outstanding people in the field that we know. I mean, who've been the really influential people in your career? And
well, I've thought about this question. I cannot come up with a single name. I mean, I have been fortunate to have worked in several different areas, and each of them have had in it very important people, very important, very substantially outstanding scientists in their own right, who are also willing to share with me their ideas and give me ideas and give me the sort of freedom to do the kinds of things I wanted to do. And so I can't limit it to one person. Certainly Jim Wittenberger played a very important role in both giving me the opportunity to work in his laboratory initially, as well as being a facilitator to sort of get me to what might be called the right places. I mean, when I told him that I wanted to go back and finish my clinical training, he made one phone call, and I was the following year at the Harvard Medical Service at the Boston City Hospital. That wouldn't have happened without Jim's intervention, I'm sure. When I got to the city hospital, I had the opportunity to meet and work with some very outstanding clinicians, as well as in the laboratory of Ed Cass. When I was going off to England, and I told Ed Cass that I wanted to come back to Boston after I finished up in England, Ed sort of saved the place for me, so that there was a place for me to come back to. When I went to England again, I asked Jim Wittenberger where to go, and it was he who directed me in part toward some of the places, really the top three places in England, and I chose to go to work with Richard Dahl. Richard Dahl was an inspirational character in the sense that he had set up a large cohort. He heard my interests at that time in respiratory disease, and he connected me with Charles Fletcher. Charles Fletcher was doing a prospective study of the natural history of chronic respiratory disease, and I worked with him for 15 years on that study. So each of these people had a very important role to play, and I really shouldn't leave out John Goldsmith, who early on had come from the School of Public Health, who sort of had a device which he called a puff meter, and you know, he showed me that you could do epidemiology and be a doctor, you know, at the same time.
So these collaborations or these mentorships with the senior people were important, but also the collaborations you've had over the years.
Yes, well, I think, in fact, it was very clear that I could not have worked in the areas that I worked in without collaborating with lots and lots of very good people, and that was probably the one advantage of being at Harvard, is that you could have, you had all these wonderfully smart, enthusiastic people around you all the time, and I saw my job as sort of describing the projects and describing the things that I wanted to get done in a way that other people could take them up and do them. And I think that was the important thing. I think if I have one legacy at all, it's the people that I worked with that really are the thing that I'm most proud of. Including yourself.
So, what do you think it is that makes a good collaboration then? I mean, we're all doing, epidemiology is essentially a collaborative enterprise. What are the characteristics that have made your collaborations successful?
Well, I think I actually learned this on the wards of the Boston City Hospital. When I went to the city hospital, I went there as an assistant resident, which means I immediately had interns under me that I was responsible for. And what I learned from the senior people at the city hospital at the same time that I had interns under me was that there is more than one way to do something. And your job, sort of in a hierarchical sense, your job was to make sure that the person who you were responsible for did their job right, but not necessarily exactly how you wanted to do it. As long as they didn't hurt anybody, and as long as the job was being done in a competent way, it was okay. So you really had to give people the freedom to do their thing as long as they didn't make mistakes, or as long as you could be sure they weren't making mistakes. It's a lot harder in clinical medicine to sort of sort that out sometimes, and it's even harder probably on the research side. But I think you want to give people their head to do their thing, their way, without trying to sort of totally control what they're doing all the time, making sure that what they're doing is being done competently, and it might not be exactly the way you would do it, but at least it's being done in a way that gets the job done. And I think that's an important component of what people need to get in a training position. The other thing that I suppose I have been able to do that has made, I think, helped make people successful is to be able to ask questions in ways that make people think about what the issues are. What I've learned over the years is that if I have a question about a particular thing, I'm probably not the only one in the room with that question. But it's clear that other people tend to hold back and not ask the question, whereas I tend to ask it. And I think that's a very good learning exercise for everyone, is that to be able to sort of get the thought processes on the table and get people thinking about them, it's an important component of learning for everybody. So I think the main thing is to, as was given to me, the respect and freedom to do your thing is what you try to engender the younger people with. And that's what I think works, given that you have very smart young people to work with. And that's what we had.
So given all the questions you've asked over the years, how have you picked out the research questions that you want to pursue?
Well, the research questions are really pretty fundamental. I mean, they really were, what's the natural history of chronic respiratory disease, and what are the components that go into causing the disease to start, to continue, to be made worse? Air pollution is one aspect of it. Cigarette smoking is obviously another. Genetic interactions. Those are all questions that sort of spin off of the basic question of the natural history of disease. On the nurses' health study cohorts, the questions are not necessarily just my questions, but they were sort of, again, it's the natural history of what happens to people as they get older. And in the particular way, I mean, I suppose there's a game of grantsmanship that goes into this, that you have to have hypotheses that are worth testing along the way. But the underlying sort of fundamental idea is that you're sort of looking through life as to what's happening in these people. And it's really not all my questions. There are other people who come forward, given that the structure is there, the infrastructure is there to look at a cohort, what are the questions that are of interest to people that are worth asking? It's other people's questions, not necessarily mine, that have sort of kept things going. I sort of set up the infrastructure, but it's other people's interests that sort of carry it. And giving the people the opportunity to do that is the, I think, the legacy.
So given that infrastructure, it's been remarkably productive. In fact, I looked this morning, you had 706 publications listed on PubMed. If that reflects, I mean, what?
Well, that reflects mostly other people's work. I mean, at this point, you know, it is a matter of working with people who are competent to do their jobs and reaping some of the benefits of that by sort of being there to help them do the work.
Yeah. Given the range of things that have resulted from these studies, even your own or the work of others that you've encouraged them to do or provided the opportunity to do, I mean, what are the things
I'm most proud of? Obviously, I fall in different categories. On the respiratory disease side, I suppose one of the things that was a surprise that had some significant impact, even though it was funded under the aegis of air pollution, was the raising the consciousness of the effects of passive smoking, environmental tobacco smoke. First demonstrated in children, but subsequently elsewhere, in which probably the impact of the environmental tobacco smoke, it was not so much physiologic on the kids as sociologic on society. And I think that's been, I remember early on one of our first publications in which there was a cartoon in the Chicago Tribune in which a woman is reading the headlines about the passive smoking effects in children while having a cigarette in her mouth and holding her child outside the window of a high-rise in Chicago. I think the impact of some of those early findings, though they were a minor physiologic effect on children, brought home to people the importance of thinking about environmental tobacco smoke. And from there, other people picked up policy issues and both other studies as well as picking up the potential for changing behavior of people in a larger scale. So I think that was a very important finding. I think the results of the Harvard Six City study had a major impact on setting air quality standards in this country. Also along the way, I think there was very important changes in how monitoring is done in this country because we needed to do that from the standpoint of the Six City study. Yourself, Jack Spengler, others had very important roles in sort of changing the way things are monitored and changing what we set standards on. So those were important things, I think, from the standpoint of the air pollution. The natural history of the effects of cigarette smoking were pretty well known early on, although I think we again substantiated some of those more completely. Nurses Health Study side, I think I like to say we have proven what our grandmothers had told us was always true. You know, if you smoke, my grandmother said you stunt your growth. But, so don't smoke, don't get fat, exercise. Those kinds of things are important lifestyle things that I think we've put some numbers to and some documentation to. Fortunately, the oral contraceptive, which was a very potent drug in the early 70s, has come down in its concentrations of estrogen content by a factor of three logs. So I think that though there are effects of hormones that are quantifiable, they're not as dramatic as we would have expected them that they might have been. And I think we've documented some of those. I think that's probably where things
are. Have there been surprises to you in findings you've seen that haven't caught the attention of the community, the scientific community, or the lay public, things that are underappreciated? Between some of these,
I think we've learned that things are more complicated than they seem, in the sense that, and one of the areas where we sort of really do need to do a lot more work is sort of trying to sort out the susceptibility of people to some of these risk factors. I used to think that people stayed in middle aged until they got sick. It's more than that. I mean, there are people who can handle their sicknesses in much more competent ways than other people. And so I think that there are either life experiences or genetic factors that sort of maintain wellness. And I think that's, in fact, an area which the nurses are now moving into in a big way, is to try to look at what some of the risk factors for healthy aging, being led mostly by Frank Rostin. I think it's just more complicated. One can't come out with simple answers that X equals Y.
So we've seen your work and the work you've initiated have a lot of influence on public policy and the public perception. But there is certainly a lot of controversy right now about the influence of epidemiology and whether epidemiology is reaching the limits of its effectiveness, that maybe we picked off all the important, strong associations. I mean, how do you see this, the influence of epidemiology right now?
I think the influence of epidemiology will continue to grow. I think it's a complex interaction that's being looked at now in many things. If journalists want simple answers, they're not going to get them. They have to learn that they're not simple answers, and they have to not try to make headlines with simple answers. The field is, I think, in a very healthy state now, in large part because it is far larger than it was 20, 30 years ago. There are a lot more people doing the work. Now, we are not going to find a smoking and lung cancer relative risk of 20 to 30 very often, maybe not at all. On the other hand, to try to understand what's going on physiologically and biochemically in people, unless you've got very good epidemiology that's phenotyping people properly, you can't answer those questions. So I think it's going to be more collaborative with basic scientists, more collaborative with physicians, more collaborative with statisticians, as all these fields come together and what is now being called big science, they've got to work together to sort of answer the important questions. It is, in the short term, prevention probably doesn't pay off, but in the long term, prevention does pay off. And the only way you can study prevention is to do it through epidemiology. I don't think waiting for people to get disease, we can afford as a society, we can't afford to continue to wait for people to get disease and treat their diseases, even if the treatments get a lot better. They're just too expensive. We've got to work toward trying to understand risk factors to prevent those diseases, and that can only be done with the leadership of epidemiology.
So you started out as a geneticist.
Yes. Well, I returned to it very on the very periphery of it, in the sense that I recognize now that the genes play an important role. I guess I've known that all along, but now the question is, how do genes play a role in chronic diseases, multifactorial diseases? And I think collaborating with geneticists, from my perspective, is the only way, is what we need to do. Several years ago, gave a talk to a group of geneticists in which I said, one or two of you will probably get Nobel Prizes, but the rest of you are going to have to do collaborative work. And they booed me at the time, but I think that's true. I think that, in fact, we do need to collaborate effectively with geneticists, but it really is going to require the tools of epidemiology to make the study sensible, if they're going to be done in a reasonable way to understand and get to the mechanisms of disease, and in order to develop strategies for prevention.
What's your advice for a young epidemiologist coming in today, starting out? Where should they be getting their training? Where should they be looking for funding? It's a tough environment
to work in at the present time. I think we are going to be moving more and more toward larger and larger groups. And we have to figure out a way to reward the junior people in those groups with effective both salary activities to work on and promotion, without necessarily looking for their name on the laboratory door. So I think, and what I tell people and have told them for years, is that they need the fundamental training in epidemiology, but along with that, they definitely need additional training in statistics, and they need probably some training in understanding basic physiology and biochemistry, or genetics. So they're going to need to be able to talk the language, and not necessarily go in the laboratory and do it, but they need to be able to talk the language. Then they need to find a place to work where they can apply those skills and have fun doing it. This should be a fun profession. And if it's not having fun, they ought to find a different place to work. But if they're having fun, and they're working hard, and their seniors are indeed looking out for them, they'll succeed. And that's sort of been the motto all along. I think it's the way it has to work. Now, it's a tough time for funding. We've been through tough times before. This may be a little tougher, only because the national debt is so much larger. But I think we'll get through this, and I think that the message has got to be, from a political sense, is that prevention will pay off. So we've got to continue to push that message so that we can actually get more money put into prevention.
So you've always emphasized, having been one of your trainees also, the importance of fun, enjoying what you do. What do you do for fun?
I come and kibitz. I come and still ask questions. I think that's part of the fun, is to be able to ask questions and stimulate people to think about the topics and fight with them over the answers sometimes, and make suggestions, and sort of that's my sort of professional fun. I've taken up painting in my old age, but That's been more learning for me than fun so far. I mean, it's fun, but and it takes up a lot of time. But I'm not very good at it yet.
And you always emphasize family and...
Yes, yeah. I think in the long run, institutions have neither hearts nor memories. The people who will cry at your grave are your family and friends. So you've got to keep them prominent in your life.
Good. Thanks, Frank.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for listening to Voices, a project of the journal Epidemiology. We hope you enjoyed it. You may also be interested in a short video clip of this interview, which you can access through the journal's website. An edited version of this interview was published in our May 2011 issue.